This is Luke Gygax, president and founder of GaryCon, and you're listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning, and welcome to Too Much Scrolling for March 22nd, 2022. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. It is spring, Chip. Spring has sprung. The weather is improving. Everybody's getting out. And boy, oh boy, I got to tell you, after 2 years of COVID, getting out is more important than ever this week.
In some areas of the world, Steve, it was 81 degrees yesterday.
That's beautiful. 60 in Chicago today. So that's and then it's going to snow on Thursday. So it's spring.
Is it going to snow on Thursday?
Of course it is. That's right. How spring works in the Midwest.
So we do weather. We do weather now on our recording too. So excellent. It'll be snow on Wednesday, and it'll be rainy here in the Carolinas.
I used to do traffic on all fours, but that's frowned upon.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Chip, did you make it to the movie theater and watch a movie this week?
I did not, Steve, but I've been waiting to see this film for a long, long time.
You finally got a chance to see Belfast. This is one of the Oscar contenders for Best Picture this year. This is Kenneth Branagh's story that he wrote and directed. I got to tell you, Kenneth Branagh is one of my favorite, maybe top five directors, maybe of all time. I really enjoy his work. How did you find Belfast?
Well, I don't think you're going to be finding it on Mystery Science Theater, Steve.
Okay, it's too good to be a bad movie, huh?
It is. This is a I understand why this was put in the category of Best Picture. I do not think it's going to win. We'll talk about that during our Oscar show. But what I wanted to say, that this is a beautiful cinematography. It's a black and white film. There is the use of color in it. Anytime the arts are being shown, those are in color, but really for the most part it is a black and white film. It starts off with this really picturesque Irish street with all the kids playing, and it's bustling and it's clean, and it really, Branagh does such a great job at making these scenes. When they're being shot, everything is square. There's a beauty to it. There's, it's warm, but it's well taken care of. And what we end up having happen in the middle of this movie, which means the second scene, is that we have a breakout of the Protestants and the Catholics, basically not wanting to live together. But like this first scene, everybody's happy. Everybody's running down the street. You're following a little boy, having a great time. And then hell breaks out. Mm-hmm. And it talks about living in war, in a war zone, and about what it means. And our lead family that we're following, dad goes away to work. He's working in England. People forget how Irish are discriminated against many times. And mom and dad start having a conversation on what type of world they want their children to grow up with. You know, do they grow up in the community that they're in, where everyone knows them? Or do they move away? Do they immigrate someplace? And mom and dad are having serious questions, like how can they give their children a better life? And they're scared. They don't have any connections. Dad, who goes away to work to bring back the bread to raise the boys, he's very appreciative. Eventually, there's a scene where dad's looking at his wife and says, "You raise these boys. You raise them to be good." But those kids are scared. Mom's scared. The whole neighborhood is scared because of what's going on around them. And, you know, all you can think of right now is Ukraine and sort of mm-hmm. what those families are going through. But this is not Russia invading Ukraine. This is two churches basically going after each other. And why would we have to live like this? And so I don't think this is a great story. Okay. I think there's some good parts to it, but there's this scene at the end with a song and dance number that's really nice. It makes a great trailer, but it's not really part of the story at all, in my opinion. And it's just there as a little gratuitous. But really the story is, what do you do when you live in a community that turmoil is going into? Do you fight it out? Do you stay because they know you? Or do you just choose to exit because then it's not part of your life?
And that's certainly something that we can imagine. And thinking back historically to this time in the 1960s in Ireland, when I don't know what I would do. I don't know if I would abandon the lifestyle that I have in the face of this terrible fear, or if I would fight. I don't know what to do.
I would leave. I mean, you can imagine how difficult that is. Mm-hmm. Picking up your family and moving across country, picking mm-hmm. up your family and moving to another country. And then which country do you move to? And then how are you treated? I mean, they were talking about their accents are going to be different. What I can tell you is that Branagh is just an incredible, incredible person to create a scene. Mm-hmm. The angles that are used in it are so amazing. Even the final scene, the little boy is walking away and he's walking this path, and you know the director told him that you will walk this, this straight path. And there's got to be some kind of symbolic, reason for doing that. But this is just, it's just beautiful. But I think this movie is like 55 out of 100.
Really?
So, yeah.
Because of the story.
I think the story, I just told you what I think the story is about. Yeah. But I don't think that it's worthy of Picture of the Year. I don't think the story is, well, the story is interesting. The story setting is important. The material they discuss is important. The execution is not as important. Hmm. And it's more beauty than important.
More form than function. Interesting. Yeah. So we will talk more about the Oscars coming up this week with our guests, Dane Michael and Kyle Hickman, our movie experts, and we'll get through the list of all of those films and figure all that out.
And I will want to mention one other thing. The reason why I delayed watching this is Belfast, I don't think, was released in the theater. It may have been. But it held on to its $19.99 rental fee. Mm. Up until March 1st. I mean, for a long time, much longer than many films do. And eventually it dropped down to a regular, the $5.99 fee. Okay. And that's when I rented it to watch it.
So there are certain films that I will pay $19.99 to watch, and Belfast was not on your list for that, huh?
Well, I would have loved to have seen it sooner. But I wasn't going to spend $20 to see this film. But many of them, they're testing right now.
Yeah.
How long do you keep a film at a premium price versus moving down to a rental price?
Mm-hmm.
And so this was one that somehow they agreed to not move it down. So it stayed much longer than typical.
Okay.
But if you wanted to match this film with another film, you could do like Angela's Ashes.
Okay.
So that was a few years ago. This is also Ireland. I think it was a different period of time as far as when the story took place. But, there's just a lot of sadness that, and then, a lot of melancholiness and, what do you do?
So, yeah. I did not see anything on TV or in the theater this week, because I was producing our 18th annual winter musical. We put on Willy Wonka this week, and I am so proud of what my students were able to accomplish, putting together a very large-scale musical, 80 students coming together, showing off their skills, and really finding joy in the performing arts. I am fully and completely exhausted, but I'm so proud of what we were able to accomplish.
Were you Mike TV?
I was Mike TV in the 1980s. I'll tell you that much. I am Mike TV in a lot of ways. There's a lot of reasons that I have a degree in computers and another degree in watching movies and putting on stage plays. And most of those are because I was Mike TV.
Excellent. I want to know about that.
That's you, right? You're Veruca. Am I Mike TV and you're Veruca Salt? Is that where we're headed with this show?
Next week. And I'm going to go stomp around the audience and then go away.
Next week on Too Much Scrolling. Opening this week, we've got some movies that are coming out, and boy, this is the doldrums. This is the spring has sprung, and nobody's going to the movie theater, and we're releasing some films this week. The first one is called The Lost City. This is the story of a novelist who gets caught up in a real-life romance novel. This is Brad Pitt, Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum, and Daniel Radcliffe. That is a list of stars for this one.
So the question is what will Brad Pitt eat in this film? Because he always eats something in a film.
Brad Pitt always eats, and Tom Cruise always runs. Though that we know that for sure.
And how will they frame a scene with Daniel Radcliffe? Because he's about like 2'5", isn't he?
Daniel Radcliffe and Channing Tatum in the scene together would certainly be a study in how tall actors are.
A G.I. Joe and a wizard.
You're a wizard, Harry.
You're a wizard. Of course, East Carolina's Sandra Bullock is going to be in there, too.
There you go. There is another one coming out. Finally, this is one of those movies that's been on the shelf for a while. It's called The Duke. This is Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren playing a married couple. The husband of the couple steals a portrait from the National Gallery in London. And basically hilarity ensues in this one.
Well, there you go. You got Helen Mirren in it. So you know it's going to be a lot of fun.
And Jim Broadbent. Jim Broadbent's amazing. There is a movie called Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. This one is intriguing to me. It's an aging Chinese immigrant swept up in an insane adventure where she alone can save the world by exploring other universes and the lives that she could have led. This is another all-star cast. Stephanie Hsu, Ki-Hoi Kwan, that you might remember from The Goonies and from Indiana Jones, Jamie Lee Curtis, and of course, every movie, James Hong.
Did you just say Short Round?
Yeah, Short Round from Indiana Jones is in this movie, and this looks like a fun, silly comic book kind of style adventure.
Excellent.
There is a not-so-fun Blizzard movie called The Infinite Storm. This is based on a true story. This is Naomi Watts getting caught in a blizzard on a mountain and a survival sort of tale.
Well, you know, there's a lot of dried foods, I guess, you'll have to eat during that time. So you can bring your own survival food.
Yeah. Yeah, let's find out how to survive on a mountain in a blizzard. There is another historical movie coming out this week called Mothering Sunday. This is Colin Firth, and of course, she's in everything, Olivia Colman. This is post-World War I England, where relationships can be very, very complicated.
Well, there you go, Steve. Those are all of our movies this week. See if you can find one, or maybe another one.
Or go for a walk because it's spring break.
Exactly. At least we'll have a lot of sunshine, Steve.
Book it. brings us to our book. At our book of the week, you have been continuing your study, and you have a book for us this week. It's called Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis. It was published over a decade ago, 2011, by James Rickards. Tell us about this one.
Well, I didn't realize it was that old. When I started reading it, because I had been reading all these books, and this was one of those ones where it kind of pops up and is recommended to you. And I said, oh, that seems interesting. This is a really good book for me. This talks a little bit about, once again, the history of banking, the history of currencies, and then what he calls currency wars, and basically led us to where our currency, the United States U.S. dollar, is today in comparison and how it fits in the world and sort of the politics that led it to be what it is right now. And so, I don't know how deeply we want to go into it, but there was a few currency wars over the last 100 years. And this kind of gives a little more details as far as how it worked. And like I said, how our policy of how the U.S. dollar works in relation to the world. I don't know if you saw in the news this week where Russia attempted to pay their bonds in rubles, which are virtually worthless right now, as opposed to a currency. The U.S. currency would be an international currency that they could pay it with. And they got through this one, I think. They have another payment in April. Mm-hmm. That it's just very unlikely. Basically, what's happening, the rest of the world has trapped Russia into they can't have access to their resources because of their invasion of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And it's just creating havoc. You realize how intertwined our countries, like all countries are, who basically work with the United States. And I'm so sorry. I'm kind of may have been mixing up a few things because I've seen so many speeches from professors and stuff like that about this subject. I think this book does address a little bit about how they work, how the United States works with emerging markets, how the United States and other countries work with each other with currencies. Why we moved off the gold standard certainly was part of this, because in 71, there was a crisis going on. France, being one of the countries, wanted to trade in their U.S. dollars for gold. This had been set up for a price. I think it was through Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And there was arbitrage going on at times because it was fixed at $35 an ounce, but the real price in the market was much higher. Hmm. There was all sorts of things going on. There is, if you ever wanted to, I don't think it's confusing, but if you ever wanted to try to grasp the levels of financial instruments and how countries work with each other, this is a really good book at kind of putting this together. Mm-hmm. And I, once again, this is just part of my continued exploration of stuff that I had studied a long time ago and just trying to refine my thoughts on it. Certainly there's a lot going on in the world right now. And, I'm just trying to find more information about it.
International currency is certainly complex, certainly all intertwined. Because this is a book from a decade ago, one of the things I see in the summary here is about Greece. And you remember that moment where Greece was about to economically fail and the rest of the world either helped or left it alone. Those sorts of things, those intertwined moments where we see how we fit into the world of currency. I don't know what a currency war is. Can you explain that?
A currency war? Well, it could be a way of undermining a country's ability to work. I mean, basically, wow. you can... So for Greece, one of the real issues that we're having is Greece has a lot of pensions, mm-hmm. a lot of obligations that they're forced to pay out. Well, one of the real issues is if you're Germany, you're moving to the euro at that time. So the Deutschmark, the French franc, the drachma, all the currencies were going to be redeemable in the new euro, and sort of how that works and how that impacts. Theoretically, you could use, well, I mean, not theoretically, you could use the euro across borders. Mm-hmm. And so some countries were in stronger shape than others. I mean, basically, Germany is the strongest economy in Europe. It worked against, the obligations that Greece had, and it put an undue strain on their economy. It became very cheap to go to, for Greek vacations and things of that nature because of that. So, I mean, basically, it talks a little bit about how countries work together, how they can work against each other. I could say a little bit more, but I don't want to get too deep into things that if you wanted to read about them, you certainly could. This is a nice presentation of the challenges we have in currencies, and it also has a lot to do with what's going on today across the world. And you can see it in war situations. You can see it in how the United States has addressed COVID, how the Federal Reserve works, how the Federal Reserve works with countries across the border. They're not the United States. I mean, there's a lot more. There's a lot to it. Mm-hmm. And this is a nice presentation. I didn't realize it was so old, but I still think it's relevant. I think that the material they brought up hasn't dated that much. Maybe the current stuff from publication date till today mm-hmm. is missing, but you're getting the gist of it. You're getting the strength of it. He could probably update it, and it'll probably be a nice help for it.
But it's good to come to a little bit of understanding of the history to understand what's happening today. So he delves into 1971, like you mentioned, and seeing the historical part from a decade ago might lead to that knowledge of today.
But he goes back further than that. So, okay. I mean, it goes, it's probably from, the founding of the Federal Reserve Bank all the way up to today, and the currency wars that it created and the havoc it created and sort of the challenges that governments face. In fact, it goes back further than that. The challenges governments face, the challenges something like the Federal Reserve, which is independent of the government, faces, and then how the central banks kind of have to work with each other.
There you go. I'm intrigued by understanding a little bit more about currency and international affairs of such things. So that's Currency Wars, The Making of the Next Global Crisis by James Rickards.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. It is March. It is spring. Everybody's getting out and stretching and playing the fun game of who's going to win the March Madness basketball tournament.
Well, it's very popular across the United States. And one of the reasons why it's so popular is that if you win your conference championship, you're automatically invited. So many schools who are, don't have a lot of exposure, many schools you may not even know about, get to play what schools that we would know a lot about. So they get to do upsets and stuff like that. So historically, only one number one seed. So there's 64 teams, well, 68 teams in the conference, in the tournament. But only one number one seed has ever lost. It happened a couple of years ago. The University of Virginia lost to a 16 seed, which was a bracket. So we've had a number of upsets where number two seeds have lost to 15 seeds.
Okay.
And guess what we had this year?
I couldn't even guess if I tried, Chip. Why don't you just tell me?
A 15 seed beat a number two seed, Steve.
Wow.
So I know it's pretty exciting. But what that basically means, it's very unlikely because those are lower seeds. Those are usually schools that are have not competed particularly well across the United States for players or any number of things. And they're usually beating one of the teams that's, favored to win the tournament. Hmm. So this year, the University of Kentucky, which I picked to win the tournament, lost in his first round to a number 15 seed, the St. Peter Peacocks, Steve. St. Peter's Peacocks. And I had never, listen, you're talking about a person who knows a lot of universities. I had never even heard about St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, Steve.
Sounds great.
So the Peacocks won that, beat Kentucky, and then they beat Murray State. They're in the Grade Eight, Steve. So this Thursday, when the games start playing again, you can cheer on St. Peter's. This little school, I'm assuming it's a little school in Jersey City, New Jersey.
There you go. The Cinderella story. I love the idea of these kids, these adults playing this game and finding that success and being that Cinderella story. There's some great drama going on here.
And the beauty is these players get to go to a location to play. And so the fans show up, and they, many times, you know, you're Duke, you're Kentucky, you know, you're St. Peter's, and you're playing, you know, just pick an area. You're playing in Greenville, South Carolina. You're playing in Charleston, South Carolina. You're playing in Richmond, Virginia, some area. Your school's not there. So the fans who show up to this game,
mm-hmm.
they just kind of pick the teams. I mean, if you're a team that's picked to win, hey, how wonderful. But if you're Cinderella, you're that team like St. Peter's, all of a sudden you get the fans behind you. And you may have 10,000 people cheering you on live. And then you throw on, the people in Vegas and stuff like that who just, you're the true underdog. No one picked you to win. I mean, those are very unlikely. People put bets down and, like, I mean, it's pretty amazing. So Valparaiso made a run a number of years ago. Virginia Commonwealth made a run a number of years ago. Butler University in Indianapolis made a run a few years ago. My school, George Mason, made it to the Final Four one year. I mean, it's just amazing that a school that's typically not known to be a powerhouse just happens to put together a team. Many times they're teams that are maybe have a lot of seniors. The players have worked together for a long time, and they're playing young kids who are freshmen who are much more athletic, probably will make the NBA, or chances of making the NBA are much higher. And it just, I mean, it brings a lot of, it's the great tournament here in the United States. It's a lot of fun.
It's fascinating to see all the social media, all the teachers complaining about their students taking up class time watching these basketball games all week.
Well, Steve, I had meetings at locations that the game just happened to be on. I mean, I'm in North Carolina where college basketball is. I mean, it's king here. And I am not kidding you. I had a meeting, and in the background, the North Carolina game was going on. Yesterday, I had lunch, the North Carolina games. I'm with my buddies, and we're all hanging out, and we're watching some games. Friday, same thing. Games are on in the background. It's just part of the atmosphere.
It's cultural. It is a part of that culture, and I get it. I understand it completely. I just don't understand it at all. There's other news other than March Madness, though, Chip. The war in Ukraine is going forward, and boy, the propaganda has become a real problem in 2022. A deep fake video purported to be Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calling on his soldiers to lay down their weapons was apparently uploaded to a hacked Ukrainian news website. This deep fake technology is truly frightening. We can make videos that really, truly look like the person that they are not, and saying words that they would not say, and it's totally believable.
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, it's you can have a person who is just have a few pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happens to be, you know, what can I say? It just happens to be that person. And it's not real.
It's not real. And that is very frightening. The idea of Photoshop modifying a picture, making you believe that this photo was true because you saw it with your own eyes. Now we have to think about what video can do, because video, you would think, maybe it has to be real. There's no way to fake it, but we have the technology to make these deep fake videos, and we have to be very careful. And that leads us maybe to thinking about what else is not real. And that's a very slippery slope.
And I should mention that, you know, you can compare and contrast this to Arnold Schwarzenegger making his plea to the Russian people to that this war is not justified, and basically asking for peace.
And what an interesting moment that was, when an Austrian native who is a big American star is speaking to the Russian people. This is an international moment. And I hope for the best with this situation, for sure.
Arnold said, "You should be in peace, Steve."
Is that what the Russian people turned to the other Russian people? Arnold said we should stop. Oh, okay. Listen, we should probably do that then. Come with me if you want to live.
He's very popular, and in fact, Putin follows. I think Putin follows Schwarzenegger. And so at the end of it, Schwarzenegger said, "Hasta la vista, baby."
So the other thing that we said hasta la vista to is standard time this week. We went into daylight saving time. Is your brain on to what time it is yet, Chip?
Well, I woke up when I normally wake up as far as the time. So maybe it took a week to get back to a regular time. But certainly I've been staying up later and sleeping in later. And it's tough.
It's like jet lag. It's like giving the whole country, or maybe most of the world, jet lag twice a year. The U.S. Senate this week passed a bill to make daylight saving time permanent, to not switch back to standard time. And I don't think this is actually going to happen, because they tried it in the 1970s and it did not work at that time. I don't know what's going to happen with our idea of setting the clocks.
Well, and they said it didn't work because people didn't like going to work, getting up and going places when it's dark. Yeah. And for people who live in the Chicago area, where it's dark for a lot of the year.
Yeah. The big grays suck, as Pat Capone says.
Well, what's really strange is, you know, it's 4 o'clock and it's getting dark. You get up in the morning and it's dark. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we work all the way up to December 25th or December 21st, the shortest day of the year, you know. And then it starts getting lighter. But as you move south, the lighter is longer. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I underestimated how much that impacts you. Mm-hmm. And as you move towards the equator, you know, it just, you know, there's even more light. So yeah. Let there be light, Steve. Let there be light.
That's it. That is it. That's the best religious thing that you could say today. all praise Chip.
By the dawn's early light, Steve.
Nice. So I don't know what's going to happen with that, but I really enjoy the exhaustion that I'm feeling from putting on a musical. I love having the sunlight and being able to get out in it this week, and then spring break is happening for me next week, so it's even better. You can hear in my voice, I am so tired. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Yes, sir. We sure can. We've got our Oscar show coming up later this week, and then we will be back next Tuesday with a regular show with Pam Bedore with our monthly book club, and have some great conversations. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube, and you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenblatt.
We'll see you in the future. Oh.